Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Boyles. .NET developer by day and game dev by night, Bay Area resident Eric Umenhofer has been quietly working on games for several years now under the comfort of his own home. First starting with XNA, then off to Construct 2, and now building with Unity, Eric is looking to release his latest work likely next year. Eric, thank you for coming on board tonight.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So it's been a while since we've had a show. I've been on hiatus for about the last 4 or 5 months. Well, I traveled a lot for summer, so it's great to have a fresh guest on and kind of get the whole series going for fall and winter again. So with that in mind, why don't you give us an idea of who you are, a little bit about your background, and how you got into programming as a whole?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always kind of been interested in computing since I was young. Mm-hmm. Back in the 80s, my family had a Commodore 64.
Oh, nice.
And I think that's always a great starter system because,
definitely,
you know, it's not like a Nintendo or any other console where you can, well, I mean, you can't just shove a cartridge in there and go, but
get those floppy disks.
Yeah, you got to kind of think about how computers work to actually get to your game.
Yeah, I mean, it was like using like a DOS prompt, yeah, and having to like navigate to the folder where it was all located.
Yeah, you basically had to know what device you were on, and you had to find the memory, you know, partition on the disk to load the right game, right? So already, like, as a child, you know, my friends and I, who also had Commodores, we were pre-programmed for,
yeah,
for understanding, like, how computers work and how devices are accessed and whatnot, just to get to a game, right? So, so I think from there, it kind of just stuck with me, you know, and that kind of permeated throughout school, and it just kind of led into a career of programming many years ago. So officially, go ahead.
I was gonna say, it's interesting you point out that you start with a Commodore and that having that computer at home is kind of what got you into programming, because NPR has a great podcast called Planet Money, and this week the episode was called Why Did Women Suddenly Stop Programming in 1984? And it was very much about that. And what they uncovered was that essentially in the 80s, boys were, you're generally pushed towards like construction toys and building things and Legos, mm-hmm, and maker kits, mm-hmm, right? Were very much girls and women's toys were like Barbies and hair and cooking things. And they discovered in 1984, same year that the home computers really started to come about, people could then go to Radio Shack, buy these cheap or affordable computers, go home, and assemble them. And at that time, they had these boys who would start with computers at 14, 15, 16, then go on to take entry-level computer science courses in college. And they immediately had an upper hand because they were so used to using the machines, very much like your story. Whereas women obviously weren't going to Radio Shack nearly as much, and Radio Shack's about to go defunct as it is. It essentially came down to what did people start off with as kids, and that really lowered the barrier to entry later on as they got older.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing, you know, a resurgence with this now, and you know, with initiatives to try and get more computer science into elementary schools and some of the earlier educational programs.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of hits the nail on the head where, you know, as I go into school, you know, I already understood, you know, how devices were accessed, what a serial cable connection was and all that stuff. And, mm-hmm, you know, how programming languages worked. I didn't even have to study it or play with it on my own. It was just using the system. You had to know how to use it anyway.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then, you know, as PCs came about and people were trading shareware games and things like that, and you kind of had to know how to hack stuff, you know, to get your game to work, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we saw this drop-off in education, too. It's like, you know, computer science became kind of nerdy, I guess, and
yeah,
people, and it really, you saw the divide where people were using computers, they wanted them to be easier, not a complicated machine that you had to learn how to use. It was mm-hmm. just something that you wanted to turn on and get to the stuff that you wanted to do.
Yeah. Work from there.
Yeah, and the people that stuck with it and were into computer science didn't care about all that. They just they kind of enjoyed the challenge of actually getting under the hood and whatnot.
Yeah, that was half the fun of it. And it's like clear to see that some companies can really take off from simplifying this, right? You look at Gateway in the late 90s and early 2000s, right? They had literally the Gateway 2000, which was mm-hmm. a very simple home desktop computer with all the parts preassembled and, you know, not a lot of the crap software on there. This way, you buy the box, and your family was good to go.
Yep.
And then now Apple obviously popularized it, right? So you have these really high-powered laptops that aren't really modular, and the RAM is soldered on, so you can't take it off. The CPUs are stuck there, but at the same time, they just simplified the process for people. So both companies really are harping exactly on what you're saying there.
Yeah, and I'm excited to see. You know, new programs go into earlier education to teach people how to use computers and to program and whatnot, because, you know, it's in every aspect of our life. You know, yeah. When your smartwatch, you know, isn't working right, most people just say, well, it's a magic box. I have no idea what's going on in there. I think everyone should know what's happening, you know, yeah. So that you understand what's going on in the world around you. You understand why your car is doing what it's doing because there's a small computer inside. Yep. Your watch is doing what it's doing because there's a small computer inside. You know, all these things. It would be great if everybody actually understood what was going on. I think we'd be in a better place.
Oh yeah, definitely. And really in the near future, it's going to be like literacy, right? Because computers will be not controlling everything, but a part of everything. I mean, your fridge is going to be running Linux at some point. Your microwave will be talking to your Wi-Fi network, which talks back to your phone. So this way you can have food ready for you when you get home, you know?
Yeah, automatic, self-driving cars, all this stuff. I mean, it's we will be driving the innovation, but computers will be doing everything else.
Yeah, I agree. It's the whole singularity. Which should we fear it or should we embrace it? I don't know.
I'm scared.
Yeah, kind of deep for this conversation. Before we get too far down that path, so you start off with Commodore as a kid, and then how did you get into your current career path at this point?
So I did, I got into computing in school and kind of stuck with it and coupled it with a business degree because I was... Because I was coming up around, so I was graduating around the time when pets.com so things were imploding, you know, around the late 90s, and I saw the writing on the wall, so I'm like, all right, I'm just gonna switch over. But you know, I stuck with the technology stack, and after I finished school, I jumped into just a regular programming job mm-hmm. with a big company. So we mostly do client based work. You know, we go to a client, we do some custom application, and I've been there since 2005. So
it's been a while.
Yeah, and it's been great. I love helping people. Solve their problems through technology. And, I started off pretty early on in the Microsoft stack, and I've kind of stuck with it, you know, and sorry to offend any other open source people out there, but, I love me some Microsoft and some C#. So,
Hey, I hear they are going more open source with their stuff day by day.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, I get kind of a frontline view of what enterprise are demanding,
yeah.
And it's becoming a very blended landscape, right? So, mm-hmm. 10 years ago, it was you were either a Microsoft shop or you were a Unix shop or you were a IBM shop or something, right? It's definitely become a blended landscape now, and. People are embracing open source a lot more today. 10 years ago, enterprises were still kind of sticking their noses up at open source.
Yeah. They wanted to protect and own all the code that they had.
Yeah, and you know, I get it, right? Because, you know, if you have a big company, you want a phone number to call if something breaks, you know, at the end of the day. You need to be able to pick up a phone 24/7 and have a support contract there. So there's always that hesitation with the open source stuff because, you know,
no one owns it, right?
Who are you going to call?
Yeah, exactly. You got to complain to somebody.
Right. And, you know, it's also interesting to see the rise of cloud-based services, especially, yes, you know, in the Azure space and Amazon.
Yeah, everyone's hopping on board, right? Because Amazon, clearly, like, the dominant force in the market. Azure is getting there. Number two, Oracle has their own service coming. Google, Apple teamed up with somebody a few months ago. So, yeah, I mean, like, the cloud is very much, you know, in the future for most large tech companies at this point.
Yeah, it's going to be great because they keep innovating on it. You know, it's like I feel like every 2 months there's a new thing that they tack on to their Azure service. You know, yeah. They
got here stuff for IoT and machine learning and big data, right?
Yep. Yeah. Actually worked on the machine learning stuff recently. It was actually kind of interesting. We coupled it with their system for monitoring devices. So you load up a little piece of code onto an embedded device, and it communicates with Azure Cloud, and you can monitor all your whatnots, lights, doors, water pumps, and everything from the cloud. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, and like that's the cool thing about embedded devices too, right? Or, you know, people commonly call them IoT now, kind of interchangeably. But I mean, the fact that they're really just there to kind of collect data and work as sensors for the most part, right? Because they're very low powered, they don't require a lot of energy, they can't do much. They can really just collect data, you know, these little $50 Arduinos, Netuinos, whatever it is.
The cool, not even collect it, they just send it.
Yeah, really. I mean, yeah, because they're not even ones doing the collecting, really. They just have like something that dangles off the USB or eSATA port, and you know, they're the ones kind of getting the information.
Yep, and then you just feed it all back into the other services that are in the cloud already. So it's kind of, you get a whole package.
Right, and all the, you know, all the number crunching and everything's being done in the cloud and just spits it back out to some other machine that someone can either, you know, view and analyze the data or figure out what they're going to do with it. So it'd be interesting to see how game developers start to harness and take advantage of that too.
Yeah, so I, you know, when I first started working on some game stuff a couple years ago, I looked to Azure for, you know, storage of things like, you know, game scores or user settings and whatnot. And it was actually pretty awesome because you can quickly deploy a web service to monitor that stuff.
Yes.
And it was really handy. I mean,
yeah. Mobile services, you know, I use mobile services now for Unity. I'm using like a Prime 31 plugin.
Mm-hmm.
And this way I just keep like the unique ID for each user, a string with their username, and a score for like the top scores. Let's say someone logs into this little shmup I'm making, they can instantly see like where they're standing compared to everybody else. But yeah, I mean, the cloud, anyone's cloud really is platform agnostic, right?
Yep.
It doesn't care, especially if you're using RESTful services, it doesn't care which device is calling it. As long as you have the endpoint and like an API key, you can hit it from iOS, Android, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of opportunity there. And I think on my current game that I'm working on, if I ever need to do any sort of online storage, I'm just probably going to go with Azure.
Simplicity, honestly, is key.
Yeah.
So you were starting off with XNA and then Construct 2. So why did you start with one or the other, and then why did you make the change?
You know, because I've been a C# developer for so long, I was just like, why should I go and learn something else just to make games? Like, I could do this. You know, I have an Xbox. I have my, you know, MSDN Ultra subscription. Let's just do XNA. It's a no brainer, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So, I jumped into it, and then I think like a day later, they're like, "Hey, we're gonna deprecate this, and good luck." You know. So I kind of was worried. I was worried for a couple of reasons. So XNA is like, I thought it was a great framework, and I think it was perfect for making games. I felt that it was more of a toolbox rather than a complete all-around platform, right? So I was kind of left hanging on a lot of stuff where I was looking to third parties to to do certain things, right? So there wasn't, I was missing a lot of out-of-the-box stuff that I was kind of expecting from a gaming framework. Right. So that kind of turned me off to start, and I felt that I found myself writing a bunch of stuff from scratch rather than focusing on the game, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But you know, the other issue was I felt I was kind of locking myself, because at the time there was no, you know, Monogame was still
like in its infancy.
Yeah, it was in its infancy. A lot of the cross-platform tools, so Xamarin hadn't even, you know, been talked about yet. So there weren't a lot of those cross-platform tools where you write it in one thing and you can push to iOS, Android, Windows Phone. So, you know, I was pretty limited to Xbox, PC, and Windows Phone at the time, which I was kind of okay with, but, you know, after I really started to think about it, I knew that eventually I would want to move to something more universal. So at that point, I kind of scrapped the idea and moved over to Construct 2 without doing a ton of research, because the webpage was... looked like it was awesome. It looked like it could do everything, right? And you know, there was talk about it being a bit being able to work on consoles at some point. So I'm like, well, you know, this could go somewhere. So I spent 6 months or so messing around with it, just kind of playing with it, and I kind of built out a little POC that touched on all the factors of the game that I would want. Mm-hmm. And then I at the same time I was doing like a little side project where I was working on a mobile puzzle game.
Okay.
And that actually finished earlier this year, but I ran into a lot of issues with publishing. So actually getting it onto the devices, like, it was just very difficult. I ran into a lot of technical issues, and the basically the way Construct works is it basically just files everything into HTML5 of some type, and then, you know, companies, if you're doing like a Windows deployment, it gives you a Visual Studio wrapper solution. It doesn't even give you the wrapper, so it gives you the base asset to put into a wrapper. So
so if you don't have a wrapper, you've actually got to make a wrapper yourself somehow.
Yeah. So what's different for Construct 2 is a little different from something like Game Maker Studio or Unity, in the sense that it still relies on third party tools to be successful. So you need the wrappers to be current. You need the wrappers to work before you can actually deploy. So my issue was that I ran into that the wrapper was, there were problems, performance issues. It would work locally. It would work on my development phones, but then when I would submit to, you know, Google Play Store or to Apple, there would be problems. And the people owning the wrapper, I had some issues actually getting any support from them, because they don't do any sort of paid support. It's all just, you know, post on the forums and cross your fingers kind of stuff.
We'll get to it when we get to it.
You know, and a month would go by before I'd get a reply, and then it would, you know, go nowhere. Right. So I kind of abandoned that project, and that really made me concerned about Construct for a larger project.
Like, if you have a commercial project that's banking on that, maybe shaky.
I was scared that I was beholden to these third parties, and I didn't want that to happen at all. So at that point, you know, I started talking to some other developers. There was a guy who made a game called Airscape, which is one of the bigger games on Construct, and it's kind of like this little, you're a little squid, and you can defy gravity and bounce around all these planets. It's actually kind of cool, but you know, he ran into a lot of issues too.
Okay.
To the point where he had to have the Construct 2 developer work directly with him to get stuff fixed and whatnot. And at that point, I was like, I need to find something with a little bit better support. I still love Construct 2. I think it's awesome for prototyping. I think it's awesome for simple web-based games. I think it's still got some time before it's ready for mobile, but I think it will be there eventually. But that said, I still love Construct, and
just gonna take some time. That's all.
Yeah. So at that point, I switched to Unity, and I had been putting it off just because
you don't want to join all the cool kids.
Yeah, you know, and the other thing, I was a little intimidated because, you know, you open up that screen, there's all this stuff, and like, you know.
Yeah, so there's a lot to understand right away.
Yeah.
Right, 'cause it's not just a framework, it's like an actual engine running inside of there.
Yeah, so you have to understand how to, the UI is custom, so it's not like it wasn't familiar to me. The way it worked wasn't familiar to me. But the one thing about Unity that sold me was the fact that you could do all of the scripting and whatnot in C#, mm-hmm. and you can make custom UIs for your, you know, components in C#. So for me, since I've been doing C# development for over 10 years, it was like, this is easy. This is cake. You know,
I can do this.
Yeah. So once I learned the UI, it was, you know, it was easy. Mm-hmm. Very easy transfer. And getting into it, you know, I love working with the tool. It's what's great about using it is that you can customize the actual UI to fit.
Yes.
To fit anything you need. So
and you can lock things in there. Yeah.
It's it's pretty great. The only thing lacking, I think, is the build tools. Coming from a, you know, kind of an enterprise development background, I use a lot of TFS. I use, you know, a lot of the enterprise TFS stuff, and I'm used to very rigid source control and build paths, and there really wasn't a lot of that with Unity. It integrates with things like GitHub and whatnot, but
yeah.
I was hoping that there'd be something in there. There's some plugins that take care of it that have kind of filled like 80% of my needs for managing builds and whatnot, but I think that's the one thing that they can work on someday. Release management.
Yes. ALM and things like that. Just backing up to Git, and they have they keep like their own meta files for everything you have too.
Yes.
So it can definitely get kind of unwieldy after a while. Yeah, so I can relate to you. So your current project is being done in Unity, correct?
Yes.
And what are your thoughts so far on using the tool and compared to what you were doing before?
I mean, it's night and day as far as power. So the game I'm working on is called Temporis, and we actually just did a Kickstarter a few months ago.
That's right.
And we're successful, and it was great. And we're full steam ahead, as they say. so far the tool has been, it's like night and day, right? I don't have to worry about all the little issues you do with HTML5 or, you know, can I do this? Is it going to work in this browser? All that stuff. So it's great knowing that, you know, when I code something that it's just going to work.
Yes.
I haven't run into a lot of issues using it, honestly. I mostly do everything in C# anyway. It's been pretty smooth sailing.
That's not radically different from, you know, any other C# you would have been doing, professional projects, right?
I find it's you tend to do a lot more simple stuff. So it's more about organizing your all the functionality as a platform rather than as like a whole custom application. So you're basically You're instead of like thinking ahead, how can this whole thing work together?
Yes.
You're thinking, how can I organize this functionality so that I can reuse it?
Yes, that's exactly what I end up doing too.
Yeah, so I find that I'm not doing as much complicated coding in Unity than, you know, say in an enterprise application, but I have to think more about building it as a whole set of utilities for reuse. So
yeah, definitely.
It's a different approach for sure. And which has been interesting too, because I find it's really hard to like plan out a game rather than, you know, an application, you know, because you have like this set of, you know, requirements when you build a regular, you know, web app, right? You say, I need this many screens and it needs to have this text on it. And this needs to happen when I click a button, right? So During game design, though, it's kind of fluid where you're kind of testing things out as you go.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, I did a POC, but you know, as you get into it, you realize this feels stupid. I don't like what I just did. So let's change it all up, right? So you kind of have to think ahead, but also be willing to completely throw everything out as you go.
Oh, I've had to do many times.
Yeah, but I also think that's why a lot of game developers get crushed when they get into it, right? They think this will just be like any other application that's ever been built. We'll plan it, we'll chug through, we'll check off, you know, all the milestones, and we'll just go. I think a lot of people get in there and they realize, A, this thing that I wanted to do is a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. B, this just doesn't work at all. Nobody likes it.
Yeah.
It's boring. I have to chuck it, right? Yep. So I think a lot of people fall into that trap.
Yeah, you're right. And I heard someone was speaking at one of an internal conference that I was at a few months back, and they were saying you should be throwing out more code than you're using. Which didn't mean like you're wasting it, but you're actually learning every step along the way, right? Or you're taking some pieces of that and using it in future projects and things. So you're not actually using it in your project or your game, but you're learning every day from just writing more and more of this code and perfecting what you're doing there, right? So you don't want to pre-optimize. You just kind of want to get it down and then worry about optimizing a lot of it later on.
Yeah. So I've kind of changed the way I program now. So my new concept is that anytime I start jumping into any major functionality, so you know, creating a pause screen or you know, dealing with platforms or you know, working on a door or something that opens, mm-hmm. I think how can I code this in a way that I could just stick it onto the asset store in Unity, right? So can I make it generic enough that I can reuse it in my game, but also can I make it powerful enough and generic enough that I could just, with a little bit of tweaking and cleaning up, can I throw it on the asset store for someone else to use?
Right.
And I think that mindset has helped me code smarter, you know, rather than just coding straight for, you know, my game. Just thinking, how can I make this piece of code, you know, generic enough that it's useful mm-hmm. everywhere.
Yeah, and I kind of get caught in that trap too pretty often. But like you said, you can always take that and sell it on the asset store at some other point later on.
Yeah, because as you're going through this stuff, you think, why hasn't anybody done this? You know, yeah. I look through the asset store and I can't find it. Like, this is ridiculous. You know, something as simple as like using an animated GIF or something. There's some plugins on there, but you know, at the end of the day, it's some of them are complicated and some of them just do almost everything I need, but then the amount of work it would have taken to change it to do what I need.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these things that I've built from scratch that I think other people could use because I'm using it.
Yeah.
So I kind of keep that in mind as I go.
Yeah, you're right. It's like a careful balance the entire way. And you're right, some of the functionality I kind of wish they did have in there, like even visual, like creating visual nodes for shaders. I mean, writing shaders by hand is painful, but then you look at what is that shader tool that you can buy for Unity?
Unity Shader.
Shader Forge, that's what it's called. So Shader Forge, awesome, awesome, awesome for creating shaders. And I look at that and I think like, 3ds Max has had it for a decade almost. Maya's had it for the same. Unreal has had it for like, you know, 4 or 5 years. Writing shaders by hand, not cool. But you look at something like Shader Forge and you're like, how does this not exist inside the tool itself?
Yeah, and I think Unity, you know, A, they have a limited development staff, so they kind of really have to choose their updates carefully. And I think that recently, I think they went down the path of 2D because they saw this huge indie game explosion that occurred, and they're like, "Our 2D tools are garbage. We need to, like, everybody, all hands on deck. Yep. We need 2D now." And they made it happen though. The 2D tools look pretty are pretty awesome right now.
Yeah, and someone had to, you know, 2D was there for the taking because, you know, XNA was no longer being supported, so who was going to pick up the ball, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, it worked out okay.
You even saw Microsoft kind of, I mean, begrudgingly tell people that Unity was the alternative, I think. I remember seeing, around the time when XNA was being announced as deprecated, I think there was some stuff going around where they were pushing people towards Unity.
Yeah, like, hey, look at this thing over here. You're going to like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ah, so, yeah, I enjoyed it as well. So now you got your tools out of the way. What is your current project? Why don't you give us a high-level overview of Temporis, when do you think it's coming out, and what can we expect for it?
So Temporis is going to be a 2D... platformer / shoot 'em up. It's a genre mixer, as they say. And it's kind of it kind of just came out of this desire to have a game that I kind of wanted. So, you know, there was a couple of influences that, you know, I played a lot of like shooters back in the day, and I played a lot of platformers on Nintendo and you know, things like Blaster Master, where you kind of had these weird mixes of gameplay, but you know, it was small enough that it worked, and you know, I just kind of wanted to smash two things together that I liked so that I could get it, you know, if I wanted to, in one place.
Oh, yeah.
And so this came about. I had been working on this platform a little bit in Construct and working on the shooter aspect, and I had met up with an artist in Canada. I met him through TIGSource, and I really liked his work, and he wasn't actually in the gaming industry. He was, or even in the digital art industry at all. So he was, at the time, I think he was working as a industrial furniture designer, making like these really cool high-end repurposed pieces of furniture, and he just did pixel art on the side. And
oh, wow. It's a pretty talented guy to just be like dabbling on the side, you know?
Yeah, so, you know, I started working with him, and we started putting some pieces together over the course of months. You know, every couple months I'd doodle some drawing, and I'd say, let's, you know, why don't you make me a spaceship or make me a character or something, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And that kept going, and then eventually I'm like, started thinking that, you know, this is actually could become something. So we tracked down a composer out of Russia named C. Jeff, and we started putting our heads together and said, you know, if we really are dedicated to this, we can pull it off. So then we set up a Kickstarter, and that occurred back in June time frame, somewhere around there, and everything went off well, and from there we've just been kind of iterating on this game, and it's moving slower than I'd like, but you know, it's one of those things, you know, life kind of gets in the way once in a while, and you know, everyone's got priorities, and the artist and the composer are, you know, they also do side projects here and there because they, you know, they're not working full time on this thing. So, you know, they got their own thing going on here and there. But, you know, we're just going at it as we can. Every time I find time to do anything, I'll call up Pete, and we'll iterate over, you know, Skype or something, and just he'll do designs and send them to me and go back and forth and whatnot. So it's basically this long distance, it's your pretty standard long distance collaboration thing that we got going on.
It all takes time, yeah. I mean, I wish games could be done overnight, but I mean, you're seeing the long way. How long ago did your Kickstarter finish?
That was like the end of June, I think.
Yeah.
I remember. It's been a few months. You know, it was interesting because, you know, I had no idea going into it, you know, what that process was like. And first thing I'll say, it was exhausting. The amount of labor that goes into it was totally unforeseen. And, you know, the cleanup afterwards is also you know, it was tough. Making sure that everybody who helped out got the stuff they needed.
Yep.
You know, and then, you know, after you get the funds, you have to start getting everything built, all the rewards. We got all sorts of, you know, stuffed animals and little toy spaceships that we're building. So
yeah, I mean, there's all this like stuff. Full-time job, just getting all that done.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty exhausting. But yeah, but now everything's in, you know, it's kind of just rolling along on its own. Everybody's making their stuff, and Pete's doing his art, and see, Jeff's going to start actually composing pretty soon, because we actually have almost enough of a demo to be able to walk around. So,
okay.
So he can start actually doing some of the audio stuff. So I'm like kind of excited. So the next couple months, So the next couple months we'll have something out. I don't know if we'll put the demo, or at least the alpha, on Steam or not, because we got greenlit too, so we can throw it up on there when we're ready.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I'll find some other sort of means to distribute it. I'm not 100% sure yet.
Yeah,
May just be like a little private FTP or something that somebody grabs it. But yeah, we're still looking to release sometime in early next year, depending on any catastrophes. So fingers crossed.
Yeah. I'll be sure to have a link at the bottom of the post, so this way people can go back, see the Kickstarter, see all the information you have on the game, and kind of get up to speed in the latest updates you have there too.
Much appreciated.
Awesome. So now we're coming full circle here on the last show. All the way back on May 28th, Richard Weeks of Total Monkery, he had asked a question for the next guest, and that just happens to be you. And the question Richard asked was, how do you view the indie game dev scene 5 years from now? Is it going to be better, worse, up, down? You tell me.
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to gauge right now, because right now I feel like the scene is it's exploding, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's mainly because of the tool sets are becoming so accessible. I mean, there's so many free, easy-to-use tool sets out there, like, you know, Construct, the Game Maker, and even just regular programming frameworks like Photon or something.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I hope people keep making games. I think the more the better, because it kind of pushes people to really try harder. You know, if there's no competition, there's no real reason to push yourself. And if there's not a huge ocean of examples too, you know, you can't really improve on what you have.
Yeah.
So I think in 5 years, you're going to see people just as soon as they jump into it, they'll be pushing out some really great content, you know? Mm-hmm. And you know, the other thing that I've seen is it's the rise of the artist programmer. You know, because the tools are getting easier to use. Someone who, you know, a few years ago was just a digital artist or a musician, now they can be a game maker. You know, they don't have to hire a programmer for the most part. You know, they can spend a couple weeks learning a tool and then just jump into it. So the gaming development world has opened up to all these creatives who were kind of once stuck behind the fact that they couldn't program, you know? So as that world opens up, it's just going to get bigger and bigger. And I'm kind of excited for it.
Yeah, especially the barriers to entry get lower. We have more diverse people coming in, people with different, you know, socioeconomic backgrounds, and just kind of different viewpoints in coming into games as a whole. Yeah, so I mean, because I mean, I don't know about you, but 15, 20 years ago, if I was a kid playing Genesis or Super Nintendo, and you told me that I could have made a game for a console in my house that all my friends could play, it would have blown my mind.
Yeah, I mean, but even a couple years ago, that was an impossible dream for a lot of people, considering you know, like dev kits were like $5,000, right? Like there was even a monetary barrier to it all. But now it's, you know, the Windows Phone stuff is free. I think now there's no more price on the contract for developing. So mm-hmm. the barriers are falling, and once they're gone, it's just going to keep exploding.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to see how things pan out. But I really only see things getting better from here as well. So now that I've asked you Richard's question, what is your question for the developer who comes on the next episode?
I'm going to say, what do you think is going to be the next trend in indie gaming? So right now it's, you know, you're kind of seeing like a lot of retro, you know, 8-bit, 16-bit platformers.
Yep.
I'm kind of curious what's the next thing?
Yeah. Or, I mean, you could even argue that, you know, Oculus, right? VR is like the big thing right now. So it'd be interesting to see, like, you know, how it starts to pan out in the future for a lot of people.
Yep.
This could get good. This could get good. Well, Eric, thank you very much for joining us today. So if people want to follow you, find you, what's the best bet? How about Twitter? Do you have a page for Temporis? What's the deal?
Yeah, so on Twitter, I am at Firebellies. That is F-I-R-E.
Yep.
B-E-L-L-Y-S.
Okay.
Spelled incorrectly on purpose. And if you want to check out Temporis, our website is www.tempor.us.
Ah, I see what you did there.
Yeah. Top level domains for the win.
That's creative. I like it. All right, well, thank you again for coming on, and hopefully we can have you back on the show after your game is finally released.
For sure.
All right. Thanks again. Enjoy.
Thanks.